content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Nicole Ruddick is titled, A Glamorous Patron Saint Links a Writer and Her Grandmother Across the Years. Over some 40 years, from the mid-1950s to her death in 2002, the French-American artist Niki du Saint-Phalle produced an enormous and varied body of work: paintings, sculptures, performative works, drawings, prints, books, films, and large-scale public and private works. Perhaps her best known is the Tarot Garden, a 14-acre sculpture park in Italy's Tuscan hills. Constructed over some 20 years, beginning in 1980, with a devoted crew, including the local postman who stopped by to help and never left, the garden is a communal cathedral, a place of secular worship populated by monumental ceramic and glass sculptures representing the 22 major arcana, realized according to a singular vision and force of will. Saint-Phalle called it the big project of my life. She needed money to carry out such a grand project. In 1982, she created a Niki du Saint-Phalle fragrance at the invitation of the pioneering aviator and cosmetics executive Jacqueline Cochran, and designed a lavish bottle featuring two entwined snakes on the stopper. Snakes are an abiding symbol in Saint-Phalle's art. For the launch in New York, Andy Warhol threw a street fair extravaganza on 32nd Street in Manhattan and invited the whole city. Saint-Phalle, who had modeled when she was 20, making the covers of Life and Vogue, wore a snake dress and a turban headdress with a pair of conjoined snakes designed by Mark Bowen of Dior. The revenue from sales of the perfume funded a third of the garden's construction. I've spent the past several years working on a book about Saint-Phalle, a gathering of drawings, prints, writings, letters, poems, books, and sketches that tell the story of her life. It is titled, What is Now Known Was Once Only Imagined, an autobiography of Niki du Saint-Phalle. In an act of fate or coincidence, my mother found a bottle of Saint-Phalle's perfume amongst my grandmother's belongings and sent it to me just as the book was released. It had belonged to my paternal grandmother, Eleanor, who died in 2000. My mother had forgotten that she had it, but reading about Saint-Phalle's perfume in my new book jogged her memory. This bottle is a less expensive edition, an eau de toilette. The 2-ounce rounded falcon is cobalt blue with a gold ball lid and two multicolor snakes painted on the front. Less than half the perfume is left, a shipper floral scent that Saint-Phalle described in quintessential terms. The ingredients are a mixture of fantastic flowers, a bit of sun, the amusement of the serpents, the mystique of the moon and stars, and a dash of love. A bottle of perfume is a dream, a hope. It makes perfect sense that Eleanor, that's what my sister and I called her, she was not a grandma in the slightest, had a bottle of Saint-Phalle's perfume. She was an avid museum goer and the first intellectual I knew, long before I knew what an intellectual was. In the early 1950s, when she was in her late 30s, she went back to school earning a bachelor's at Hunter's College, where she took classes in medieval literature. My father still remembers the first line of the Knight's Tale from Chaucer's Canterbury Tales because she recited it so often. Then came a master's degree and an education doctorate at Columbia University, after which she taught nursing at Columbia's Teachers College. She worked mainly with women. There were no male nurses in the U.S. until the 1980s, and she would say that there was nothing in the world a woman couldn't fix. She and my grandfather divorced after their children left home, and she spent the rest of her life single and embarking on her own adventures, first in Manhattan, then in Dobbs Ferry, New York, and much later in Texas, where we lived. She smuggled lox and bagels in her suitcase whenever she came to visit us. She read voluminously, especially English women novelists, subscribed to The New Yorker and The New York Times, she did the Sunday crossword in pen, took Russian folk dancing and ballet, even into her 70s, and was active with the League of Women Voters and children's organizations. She traveled every year to London, where she met up with friends and artists and went to scores of exhibitions and theater performances. I still have a few of the press folders from the Tate she brought back for me. Her hair never grayed. She was a terrible cook. She held lifelong grudges, including against her only sister. I admire her. Eleanor was also stylish. She bought boxes and boxes of designer Italian shoes, especially tall leather boots and strappy sandals. She said she wanted to be reincarnated as a centipede so that she could wear more shoes at once than 2 feet would allow. She didn't have a lot of money, but what she had, she spent well. She owned dozens of Liberty scarves, long tweed and wool skirts, and Scottish cashmere sweaters bought at W. Bill on Bond Street in London. Her favorite outfit, and how I remember her, included a Liberty scarf, a pleated skirt, a cashmere sweater, and a pair of Ferragamo boots. And perfume. She always smelled wonderful, a scented cloud of someplace more interesting than Texas. When she went to department stores, she'd return with mini perfume samples from which my sister and I were free to choose. Imagine a fifth grader wearing Dior Poison. When she died, I took some of her sweaters, but the shoes, alas, were too small. I've never laundered some of the sweaters, which I wear sparingly because they smell like Eleanor's perfume, whichever one she chose to wear last. One whiff of the scent and thoughts of her bloom instantly in my mind. After her death, my mother gave me a poster Eleanor had bought and framed. Made by Saint Fall and Jean Tingley, a Swiss sculptor and Saint Fall's partner and longtime collaborator, it served as an invitation to an exhibition in 1983 of works related to their Stravinsky fountain outside the Centre Georges Pompidou in Paris. Eleanor didn't travel beyond England, but perhaps a London friend gave it to her. Or maybe she bought it in New York at the same time she bought the perfume. I think the last time I saw her, I was living in New York, and she had come to visit. We met at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and had lunch there, as apt an ending as any. As I've gotten older, I've come to understand that Eleanor and I have quite a lot in common. A deep love of literature and art, to say nothing of a knack for permanent hard feelings. And I often wish she were alive to see what I've done and who I've become. I wonder, too, not only about our commonalities, but about our deeper correspondences. What did she feel, for instance, when she looked at St. Fall's art? I feel sure that we were drawn to it for some of the same reasons. St. Fall's representation of women, her joy, her abundant and expressive colors, and her independence. And we are linked by it. We are linked, too, by an urge for uncommonness and adventure. An urge, one might say, for a mixture of fantastic flowers, a bit of sun, the amusement of the serpents, the mystique of the moon and stars, and a dash of love. Our next article by Bethany Heitman is titled, Texas Halted Melissa Lucio's Execution for Now, But the Fight Isn't Over. On April 25th, the highest criminal court in Texas granted a stay of execution to Melissa Lucio. Had this ruling not come through, Lucio would have been put to death on Wednesday for a crime that she says she didn't commit. And while this ruling buys her more time, the fight for her life is not over. In 2008, Lucio was convicted of capital murder after the death of her 2-year-old daughter, Mariah. Prosecutors in the case alleged that Mariah had suffered physical abuse leading up to her death, though there was no evidence that Mariah or any of Lucio's other 11 children had ever been abused. Instead, Lucio says that Mariah accidentally fell down a steep staircase on February 15, 2007. After the fall, Lucio says that Mariah seemed fine. But 2 days later, Mariah took a nap and never woke up. Hours after Mariah was pronounced dead, police detectives hauled Lucio, who was pregnant with twins, into an interrogation room. Detectives deployed something called the Reed Technique, a controversial interrogation method that has led to a number of wrongful convictions. Over the course of 5 hours, Lucio stated her innocence over 100 times. Eventually, though, she began to repeat the phrases that investigators had seemingly coached her to say. "I don't know what you want me to say," she said to the investigators. "I'm responsible for it. I guess I did it." Something that's important to know about Lucio is that she was sexually abused at a young age and experienced domestic violence in her first and second marriages. In the years since her conviction, mental health professionals have gone on the record to say Lucio's history of childhood sexual abuse and domestic violence made her uniquely vulnerable to the pressure tactics used in the police interrogation and more likely to issue a false confession. Not only this, during Lucio's trial, the jury was told that Mariah's injuries could only be explained by child abuse and that complications from an accidental fall were impossible. Since then, respected healthcare professionals have said this is not accurate. With the most recent news, Lucio's case will go back to court where they will review her claim of innocence, along with the claim that false evidence was used to convict her. From there, it will be decided if Lucio is granted a retrial. Continued awareness and interest in this case is key, as it will help put pressure on the courts in Texas to do the right thing. Here, one of Lucio's lawyers, Vanessa Potkin, director of special litigation at the Innocence Project, who has been working hard to see that Lucio goes free, shares more about the case. Melissa says she falsely confessed. What can you tell us about that? She was the victim of sexual abuse as a child and was in abusive domestic relationships as an adult. Those experiences shape how she responds to traumatic situations. When paramedics got to the house, they noticed that Mariah was in distress and had stopped breathing. They thought Melissa was detached. The rushed judgment against her had to do with stereotypical notions of how a mother would respond in a situation like that. That worked against her in the interrogation room. There are parallels between the actions of a perpetrator of domestic abuse and interrogators. To isolate somebody is to dominate, so she was more vulnerable to acquiescing to make this coercive experience stop. She had just experienced this tremendous loss of her daughter. Within 2 hours, she finds herself in an interrogation room where armed male officers are telling her she had to have done this, she was a bad mother. They're scrutinizing her parenting decisions, showing her photographs of her dead child, and saying she must be responsible. They also implied they would go after some of her teenage children next. Over 100 times, Melissa asserted her innocence and they refused to accept it. For 5 hours, she's telling people something and they interrupt, saying that can't be true. The result is she takes responsibility falsely for some of Mariah's injuries. What else happened during her trial that led to her conviction? The state presented this absolute testimony from a medical examiner saying the injuries could only have come from being beaten, and that just was false. There was medical evidence available at the time that the state ignored and that the defense attorney failed to bring to the jury's attention. It showed that all these injuries were consistent with an accidental fall. There is also the intersection of race. There have been studies about how parents of color are unfairly targeted as the victims of false accusations when their children are injured in a non-abusive way. There was a presumption that Melissa must have done something. One of our affidavits is from a pathologist named Dr. Michael Laposada, one of the world's most preeminent clinical pathologists. He highlighted how if a child has profound bruising throughout their entire body, that could be an indication of abuse or it could be a blood disorder. Jumping to the conclusion that it had to be child abuse was such an egregious error, one that is potentially sending Melissa Lucio to her death. There's been incredible bipartisan support for Melissa. More than 80 members of the Texas House of Representatives and over 20 state senators have been vocal about believing she deserves clemency. Has that surprised you? It surprises the heck out of me. That's unprecedented. We're talking about Texas. Representative Jeff Leach has been deeply moved by Melissa and was so disturbed by the evidence of her innocence and the fact that this execution was going forward. He's really been using his voice. It's unprecedented to have 100 members weighing in and asking the Texas Board of Pardon and Paroles to not let this execution go forward. If her execution, with all of this support and new evidence, still goes forward, I just don't know what hope there is for anybody in the system. What do you hope are the next steps for Melissa? She deserves a new trial. She shouldn't spend the rest of her life in prison for something that wasn't even a murder. She had 7 kids under the age of 10 in one household. She was working part-time, pregnant, and living in poverty. At times, they didn't have running water. She was challenged. She was introduced to drugs by one of her partners. The children were taken into child protective custody and were in foster care, but she worked really hard to get her children back. She stopped using drugs. She got a job. She did supervised visits over the course of 1.5 years. Even throughout the poverty and what she experienced, she just always felt like if the kids and the family were together, they were okay. That also is something that stood out to us. Child Protective Services was in the family's life extensively for a few years. There were thousands of pages of records from different visits over the course of many years, and not one kid ever accused her of abuse. There was no abuse suspected. What can you tell us about Melissa today? She is a woman of faith, and that is what has sustained her throughout this ordeal, as well as her children. One of the things she's expressed as her concern, which I think every parent can relate to, is, when I'm not here, who's going to provide for my children? While she hasn't been able to be with them physically, she has been an emotional force in their lives. She's reflecting back on life and what could she have done differently. She's consumed with thoughts of her children, and now she has grandchildren, so that is predominant in her mind. She is so appreciative and overwhelmed by the support she's received. To be visited by lawmakers, to see everyday people signing petitions and going to rallies, that gives incredible strength. At the end of the day, she has optimism and realism. Is there anything that people can do? It's important for people to speak out. In Cameron County, district attorneys are elected and they're accountable to the people. It's important for people to get involved in local elections. When we talk about voting and being active members of the democracy, we think about presidential elections, but district attorneys make such a difference. They yield an enormous amount of power. We're seeing it in Melissa's case, what a difference a district attorney can make. The Innocence Project works with district attorneys throughout the country who cooperate to reinvestigate claims of innocence. The district attorney in Cameron County, where Melissa's case is really out of step with other district attorneys in terms of a complete unwillingness to reconsider the case. At a recent hearing, he acknowledged that he hadn't even read the new information. He didn't even know when Melissa's scheduled execution date was. Our next article by Nicole Lynn Lewis is titled "The Cost of Mother Shaming." On my first Mother's Day, a beautiful sun-drenched Sunday, I held my nearly one-year-old happy, healthy daughter, overwhelmed with both gratitude and a need to protect her. I had learned early on that Mother's Day is a day of celebration for some mothers, and that our selectiveness about which mothers are deserving of support and resources is evident every day of the year. These biases, often used to shame and villainize mothers who do not meet the accepted definition of good, create disparities for millions of women and families across the country, especially for one of the most maligned groups, Black teen mothers like me. Teen motherhood is a fact in this country. Though birth rates have been dropping for this group since 1990, the U.S. teen birth rate still remains higher than many other developed countries. And once a young woman becomes pregnant, we make it incredibly difficult for her and her baby to thrive. Teen mothers face an economic impossibility. Education is one of the best paths to higher wages and fulfilling careers, but with almost no legislative or institutional support, only about 50% of teen mothers finish high school by age 22, and fewer than 2% finish college by age 30. On average, a year of infant child care across the U.S. is more expensive than a year of attending a public four-year college. Negative stereotypes about young mothers suggest that the main reason for their lack of academic success is an indifference to their education. As the founder of a nonprofit called Generation Hope, I've worked with hundreds of teen parents, and my colleagues and I see the exact opposite of apathy. These mothers are highly motivated to create a better life for their children, but one hurdle after another can make it feel impossible. Their difficult journeys mirror my own. I was 8 months pregnant, living day to day in a Motel 6 when I found out that I had been admitted into William & Mary. In the coming months, I scraped together the $300 to confirm my enrollment, found a one-bedroom apartment that was 45 minutes from campus but at least provided stable housing, worked with the financial aid office to ensure I qualified as an independent student when my daughter was born, allowing me to receive enough aid to pay my tuition. Coordinated with my boyfriend to use our one car, a 1976 Cadillac, to get to and from campus each day, and arranged childcare with his sister, which was free but made my commute to drop her off and get to campus, then do it all over again in the evening, 150 miles. Those were the dots I had to connect in order to start college with a three-month-old baby in tow. I wish there had been a formal support system in place designed to help me succeed, but instead I had to patch together my own. When my relationship with my boyfriend turned physically abusive, I decided to leave him and spent hours combing through William and Mary's family housing policy. There was a loophole. It was intended for married, adjunct, and assistant professors, but it didn't explicitly state that an undergraduate with a baby couldn't live there. I moved in just before the start of my sophomore year after several months on the waiting list. Then a slot opened up in the school's child care center where the professors and staff took their children. My daughter attended the beautiful facility nestled in the middle of the wooded campus until my senior year when I could no longer afford the $800 monthly tuition. Thankfully, by then, she qualified for Head Start, one of the few subsidized child care and early education programs, making the cost go down to just $35 monthly. With a disinterested advisor and most of my professors unaware of the fact that I was a mother, I didn't have many advocates on campus, but I found one in my financial aid counselor, who helped me access the grants and loans I needed to stay in school and barely cover groceries, housing, and child care. Every day I encountered people's disapproving looks and hurtful assumptions about who I was and who I would become, all while struggling to shield my daughter from how hard things were and to stay on top of my studies at one of the most prestigious schools in the country. The road to economic mobility is an arduous one for young mothers, but this has more to do with historic, systemic racism and institutional barriers than her child. Black girls are 2 times more likely to experience a teen pregnancy than white girls due to a myriad of reasons, including limited access to birth control and a history of discrimination and bias in the healthcare system. A less discussed factor is the reality that 1 in 4 black children are living in poverty in America. And despite the pervasive notion that teen pregnancy causes poverty, poverty causes teen pregnancy. 71% of the more than 10 million U.S. children living in poverty are children of color, cutting them off from proper nutrition, quality education, reliable housing, and more. Teens who are already living in families with low income are much more likely to get pregnant than their more affluent peers, and they are also more likely to carry their pregnancy to term, in part because other future achievements seem so implausible. It is not teen motherhood that determines future success, but instead a young person's economic position. Research shows that young women growing up in poverty have similar economic outcomes regardless of whether they experience a teen pregnancy. Even before pregnancy, the K-12 system is often an invalidating place for girls of color. For example, black girls are more than 5 times likely to be suspended at least once from school and 3 times more likely to receive referrals to law enforcement than white girls. If they do become pregnant, there are few supports in place to ensure they complete high school, and they are often pushed out of education spaces by shame and stigma at a time when they need the most support, an occurrence I often see in my work with Generation Hope. Some of the people in institutions best poised to help black girls through pregnancy and young motherhood instead use shame to further marginalize them because they are reluctant to give up or challenge the stereotype that black teen mothers are undeserving and unworthy. If young black mothers are successful, then there is less evidence to justify their bias and the withholding of resources. About 1 in 5 college students in the U.S. is parenting, including almost half of all black female undergraduates. Despite their motivation to complete college and maintaining higher GPAs on average than other students, our perception that they are undeserving of support and the barriers that those perceptions create make them 10 times less likely to graduate. Millions of mothers have economically suffered unnecessarily during this pandemic, many who started their families young, black and Hispanic mothers most of all. Those of us who work with families know that their challenges are not new. Rather, they've just been highlighted and intensified by COVID-19. We also know that the solutions for coming out of this stronger and better as a country are, and always have been, right in front of us. When we accept that the cause of teen pregnancy are deeply connected to systemic racism and long-standing structural barriers to economic mobility, we can let go of using shame as a deterrent. It is not only ineffective, but also causes perennial harm to young mothers and their children. Next, let's stop treating this population like a small group that is disconnected from the major issues we care about. We cannot hope to end child poverty without supporting these mothers and their children. We are all connected to and depend on these young women. Young mothers are working as your barista at Starbucks, or your Uber driver, or your night shift nurse at the hospital. We can help them thrive by investing in K-12 and higher education spaces that consider the needs of young mothers and parenting students by being flexible, inclusive, and accessible. We need real solutions like universal pre-K and subsidized childcare. Policies like the child tax credit payments dispersed in 2020 and 2021 that can remove financial sinkholes for families, and programs that provide wraparound holistic support to both parent and child, including mentoring or coaching, mental health services, academic help, and more. Over the years, I've kept the homemade Mother's Day cards my daughter has scribbled on folded pieces of construction paper because they've always reminded me that she has been in my corner cheering me on even when others weren't. She was there holding my hand when I walked across the graduation stage 4 years after we stepped foot on William & Mary's campus, and I could tell by the way she looked at me that day that she never doubted my ability to graduate, not even for a second. And that's the answer. Young mothers, like all mothers, deserve a cheering squad, an abundance of resources and support, and people who never doubt them, not even for a second. Nicole Lynn Lewis is the founder and chief executive officer of Generation Hope, a nonprofit organization that engages education and policy partners to drive systemic change and provides direct support to teen parents in college as well as their children through holistic two-generation programming in order to ensure all student parents have the opportunities to succeed and experience economic mobility. Nicole holds a master's degree in social policy and communication from George Mason University and a bachelor's degree in English from the College of William & Mary. Nicole and her husband, Dante Lewis, live in Maryland with their 5 children. She's the author of Pregnant Girl, A Story of Teen Motherhood, College, and Creating a Better Future for Young Families. Our next article by Leslie Goldman is titled, What You Need to Know About Hormone Therapy. The use of hormone therapy, the R has been dropped from HRT because we're not trying to replace what the ovaries make. We're just trying to manage symptoms, which requires far less, says Stephanie S. Fabian, MD, medical director of the North American Menopause Society, or NAMS, has been one of the most debated topics in menopause care. Certain HT, estrogen or estrogen plus progesterone in a pill, patch, cream, gel, spray, or vaginal ring, is approved by the FDA to treat many perimenopausal symptoms, but there are risks. Yet many medical experts, as well as NAMS and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, agree that for many women, the benefits of HT outweigh those risks. Here's a Just the Facts, Ma'am overview. HT is hands down dangerous. False. The dark shadow over HT dates to 2002, when findings from the Women's Health Initiative linked the use of HT with an elevated risk of heart disease, stroke, and breast cancer, rocking patients' worlds and doctors' prescribing practices. Usage plummeted from about 40% of postmenopausal women to about 4%. Researchers discovered that the study was seriously flawed, and for symptomatic women under age 60 who are within 10 years of their last period, the benefits typically outweigh the risks, Fabian says. HT offers significant symptom relief. True. The therapy extinguishes 90 to 95% of hot flashes while benefiting mood, sleep, and vaginal dryness, massively improving quality of life, and may offer long-term protection against heart disease and osteoporosis. HT is right for everyone. False. Those with a history of a hormone-dependent cancer, like breast cancer, blood clots, heart attack, or liver disease should avoid HT. Other risks include spotting, breast tenderness, and blood clots. But for women like Malone, who told Michelle Obama that she took hormones during perimenopause, it can bring much-needed relief. If you still have your uterus, you'll need progesterone along with your estrogen patch, pill, ring, gel, or spray to avoid an increase in endometrial or uterine lining cancer risk. HT contains high levels of hormones. False. Malone says patients are often surprised to learn that HT contains lower doses of hormones than low-dose birth control pills. Yet women aren't afraid of birth control pills, but they're afraid of HT. Our next article by Maria Shriver is titled, "I'm ditching the term anti-aging from my vocabulary." Just a few months ago, I turned 66 years old and spent the day celebrating with my family and dear friends. I took a hike in the Santa Monica Mountains. I had a big slice of a homemade Betty Crocker cake, a sweet tradition in our family. And in between heart-melting snuggles with my baby granddaughter and belly laughs with the people I love most in the world, I had a revelation. This was the first birthday since my 20s that filled me with joy and hopefulness for what was to come rather than a sense of the loss of my youth. I've been thinking a lot about loss lately. So many of us are grieving the loss of loved ones due to the pandemic. Maybe you're grieving the loss of life as you knew it before COVID, or how easy it used to be to do things like go out to eat, travel, or see a Broadway show. Many of us are grieving for our country right now, which feels more divided than ever before. What I've realized is that the more comfortable I can get with grief, the better. That's a tall task considering grief isn't modeled in our society. But what I know with certainty is that embracing the fact that grief is a part of life is crucial, especially as we get older. I'm not sure you ever really get comfortable with grief, but you can learn how to understand it and how to survive it. I used to be terrified of the death of my mother. I didn't think I'd make it through that loss. Then she passed away, and while it hasn't been easy, on some days I'm still overcome by the loss, it's helped me to see how life goes on. It's helped teach me how to ride the waves of my grief. It's helped me understand grief just a little bit better, which helps me face all kinds of losses. People I love, opportunities that passed me by, old identities that used to serve me, with more strength and even a sense of wonder. My ever-growing curiosity is why I decided to interview more than a dozen people on how to age well and how we can rethink the aging process so it fills us with a sense of hope, not despair. My birthday landed shortly after I had filmed the Radically Reframing Aging Summit, and its inspiration motivated me to do my part in rewriting the narrative about aging in our country as well. Here's how I'm trying to do that. Number one. I'm pro-aging and officially ditching the term anti-aging from my vocabulary. The old storyline about aging, how we need to fix ourselves or do everything in our power to look the way we did when we were in our 20s and 30s, needs a major revise. Unfortunately, the media continues to perpetuate that old tired storyline, and it's prompting too many of us to downright dread getting older. But it doesn't have to be that way, and I'm on a mission to rewrite that story as I live it. I worked with my daughter, Christina, on the Radically Reframing Aging Summit. At the end of our 3 days of filming, she shared with me how inspired she felt about getting older. She told me that at age 30, most of her friends already say they feel old, and that the summit made her rethink that notion. It was the best compliment I could have received because it showed me her generation is looking for wisdom and inspiration from others on how to age well. It felt like proof that all of us can believe our best days are ahead of us. Now, being pro-aging doesn't mean I'm giving up on wanting to look my best. It just means that the end goal isn't to look as young as possible. I've started to pay more attention to my skin thanks to my daughters, who've turned me on to clean products and remind me of the importance of sunscreen. They also encourage me to think about what I wear. I've added beautiful dresses to my wardrobe in recent years. And all of my kids prioritize clean eating and remind me of the fact that good food makes you feel good. All of this helps me not just look vibrant, but feel vibrant as well, and that's what's important to me. Number two, I'm not working towards retirement. When I was a kid, I never heard the word retirement. My house was always filled with people of all ages who were working in government, social justice, and nonprofits. My parents worked tirelessly on causes that were important to them, and they were still flying all over the globe well into their 80s trying to change the world. Even as my father was battling Alzheimer's disease, people he worked with in the Peace Corps came to visit him to talk about what they were doing. That was my model, and I believe it's one all of us can learn from. The idea of working for retirement just feels so off. Our cultural idea of retirement, aging out of a job and not working anymore, or working with the main goal to stop working at a certain date, leaves so many vibrant people flailing for purpose. Instead of retirement as an end, we should think of it as a springboard to a new stage. Did you work for decades not doing something you really enjoyed, but that paid the bills and helped you raise a family? Once you're able to stop doing that job, you have an opportunity to ask yourself, what do I want to do that feels meaningful? You have a chance to do something that feels fulfilling. What will that be? When I was considering launching a company with my son Patrick, so many people told me not to do it. Why would you become an entrepreneur now, they said. Aren't you ready to take a break? My answer to these questions was and remains clear. No, I'm so proud of Mosh, the mission-driven brain health and wellness brand we created, and I can't even begin to tell you how much fun it's been working with my son on this project and how it's deepened our connection. I try to work on projects with people I love and care about and see myself continuing to do that. Rather than count down the days until you can retire, why not think about the new opportunities every birthday presents? Are you living a wildly authentic life? If not, what can you change so you can answer that question with a resounding yes? Number 3, I'm embracing how much more time I have now and trying to make the most of it. I've never felt freer than I do now. When I think about why this is, it's because I spent so much of my 30s, 40s, and 50s doing things that filled me with joy and took a lot of time and energy. Raising children, building a career, being in a marriage, caring for my aging parents, all these things were big parts of my life. Now I work with my kids, but I'm not raising them. I work on things my parents started, but I'm not a caregiver for them. I'm single now too. All these things that were such big parts of my life are now behind me, and I have this wide open field that's now in front of me. Now that I'm not building my day around carpool plans and parent-teacher conferences, I'm building things I didn't have a chance to build before and doing things that spark my curiosity, things I hope will change the conversation. I founded the Women's Alzheimer's Movement, or WAM, and I'm on a mission to raise awareness about this devastating disease and figure out why it impacts so many more women than men. I built Shriver Media to produce documentaries, films, and all kinds of content that inform, inspire, and ignite people to build a better world. I created the Open Field Book imprint with a goal of publishing voices that rise above the noise and light the way forward for others. I am working on so many projects that keep me feeling engaged, continuously learning, and working with people who excite me. I'm using this newfound time I have in my 60s to live a life of purpose. And even if what I set out to do isn't realized in my lifetime, my hope is that at some point someone else will pick up where I've left off. Number 4, I'm taking small steps every day to improve my health span, not just my lifespan. When I interviewed the great neurosurgeon and longevity expert, Dr. Joseph Maroon, he said, "I want to die young as late as possible." I love this. With advances in healthcare, we're all living much longer than ever before. Yet it's not just about how long we live, but how good we feel as we get older. If you have your health, aging is a great gift. And to keep your health, you have to put in some work. Every expert on aging I've ever talked to has told me that the small things you do every day to improve your physical, mental, spiritual, cognitive, and emotional health really do add up to big gains. Of course, the sooner you prioritize your health, the better, but it's never too late. You can always take steps that'll have a positive impact on how you age. I eat as many fruits and vegetables as possible, in addition to the occasional indulgence. Sugar is my weakness. I move my body every day, even if it's just a walk around the block or a pre-dinner dance party with my granddaughter. I drink loads of water. Just as important are the things I do for my emotional and spiritual health as well. I meditate every day. I try to have one meaningful connection with a friend every day. And just like my parents did, I surround myself with young people. I love hanging out with all of my kids and my grandchild. It reminds me of the importance of playing and creativity. It helps me feel young. While none of us know how long we have on this earth, we do have the power to take steps towards optimizing how we feel during the time we get. Number 5, I'm thinking about aging as a gift rather than something to fear. The gift of getting older, how blessed we are to age, is a message that gets lost when we talk about aging. What a shame. That's not to say fear isn't going to emerge as we get older. There are so many unknowns, which all start to feel a bit closer than ever before. However, just like it's essential that we actually look at our grief and get comfortable with it, it's crucial that we do the same with what we fear. When I spoke to William Shatner about going to space at age 90 and asked if he was afraid, he replied, "Heck yeah, I was scared." When I asked him how he pushed through that fear, he told me about his commitment to saying yes to the things that scare him the most. "You've got to say yes," he said. "You've got to get out, and you've got to do that even though you'd rather sit and watch TV. If you're living your life as you get older and you're frightened by things, you've got to say yes." I believe one of the keys to feeling like aging truly is a gift is to continue to stay curious, try new things, and not let the number of candles on that birthday cake prompt you to say no more than you say yes. Number 6, I'm remembering that how I think about aging has a direct impact on how others may think about it too. We have so many role models right now of people doing incredible things in their 80s and 90s. Look at Warren Buffett running his company in his 90s and Frank Gehry designing the most extraordinary building in his 90s. Tony Fauci is leading us through a years-long global pandemic. Nancy Pelosi is at the top of her game. Ageism exists, to be sure, but I believe the best way to counter that is to be a living, breathing example of how to age well. We all have the power to rewrite the narrative about aging in our society, which will create a ripple effect. My generation is a revolutionary one. We have been through so much. We are survivors who are here to prove that you can be broken and fail and still grow and change and lead with love. The way I see it, we can either grieve the loss of our youth and inspire our young people to feel sad as they get older too, or we can reframe how we think about aging so it's something that ignites excitement and hope for our future. I know what I want my granddaughter to think when she blows out the candles on her Betty Crocker cake when she's in her 60s, 70s, and beyond. And I'm going to do everything I can to set the kind of example in my own life that I want her to follow. Who's with me? Our next article by A.J. Hanley is titled, "Why Banning Menthol Cigarettes Matters." Even though smoking numbers have largely declined in the past decade, menthol is a cigarette that nearly 18.6 million Americans smoke. Menthol has a cooling analgesic effect, and as an additive to cigarettes, it numbs the throat and masks the harshness of tobacco, which makes it easier to start smoking and harder to quit. But now might be the time to wean off the minty sticks. The Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, announced that it is gearing up for a nationwide ban on menthol cigarettes, something public health and many civil rights advocates say is long overdue as it will improve public health in America, reduce health disparities, and advance health equity. Given that nearly 500,000 Americans die prematurely from tobacco-related diseases each year, eliminating menthol cigarettes is intended to save lives, particularly among communities that are targeted and disproportionately affected by these products. Read on for 5 ways menthol cigarettes affect the nation's health and how banning it could make a difference. Number 1, menthol cigarettes take a toll on public health. Menthol's ability to cool and numb the throat masks the harshness of the tobacco smoke. This may give smokers the illusion that the cigarettes made with the additive are healthier or safer than ordinary cigarettes, but that's definitely not the case. In fact, menthol allows smokers to inhale more deeply, which increases exposure to harmful chemicals and carbon monoxide. As a result, these smooth smokes have lured in a generation's worth of new smokers. One study looked at the effect of menthol cigarettes on public health from 1980 to 2018. The researchers reported in the journal Tobacco Control that menthol cigarettes accounted for more than 265,000 new smokers each year during the 38 period. In addition, it found that menthol cigarettes were responsible for 10.1 million additional smokers, 3 million life years lost, and 378,000 premature deaths in those decades. This report suggests that banning menthol cigarettes could curb tobacco use and prevent needless deaths, as anti-smoking advocates say. Number 2, menthol cigarettes are used by 85% of black smokers. In the 1950s, less than 10% of black smokers used menthol cigarettes. But in the decades that followed, that number grew because menthol cigarettes were more heavily advertised in urban neighborhoods with higher numbers of black residents. For decades, tobacco companies have deliberately targeted the black community with marketing of menthol cigarettes, retail promotions, and sponsorship of community and music events. The effect of this targeting is staggering. Among black Americans, menthol cigarettes were responsible for 1.5 million additional smokers between 1980 and 2018, according to a different tobacco control study that specifically examined the effects of menthol smoking on African American communities. A ban on menthol cigarettes will likely have a favorable impact on black communities, which are already burdened by the hazards of smoking. Number three, menthol cigarettes impact the health of black Americans the most. In 2020, 14.4% of black adults smoked cigarettes, according to the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC. While this isn't a majority of the population, tobacco use is the number one cause of preventable death among black Americans, claiming 45,000 lives each year. It's a major contributor to three of the leading causes of death in African Americans, including heart disease, cancer, and stroke. Menthol cigarettes are directly related to this, with more than 8 of 10 black American smokers reaching for menthol cigarettes. The result is a community that has seen 157,000 smoking-related premature deaths and 1.5 million excess life years lost during the years between 1980 and 2018. So while black Americans constitute 12% of the U.S. population, they represented an additional 15% of smokers, 41% of deaths, and 50% of the years of life loss due to menthol, according to the aforementioned tobacco control study. A ban on menthol cigarettes will help prevent loss of life. Number four, tobacco companies use marketing to draw kids to menthol cigarettes. Tobacco companies are strategic marketers using themes and images that attract young people. They also depend on menthol to mask the harsh, acrid taste of tobacco, which makes them more palatable to novice smokers. And it works. Data from National Youth Tobacco Surveys reveal that, compared to regular tobacco products, menthol and mint-flavored tobacco products are associated with greater smoking frequency and intention to continue smoking. Today, 41% of high school smokers use menthol cigarettes, and these kids continue to smoke into adulthood. 90% of adult smokers began their relationship with tobacco when they were teens or younger, according to the FDA. Taking menthol cigarettes out of the equation could go a long way towards increasing the quit rate and protect future generations from harm and addiction. In a longitudinal study from the Truth Initiative, Schroeder Institute in Washington, D.C., nearly a quarter of young menthol smokers, ages 18 to 34, said they would quit smoking if the minty cigarettes were no longer available. Number five, menthol cigarette smokers have a harder time quitting. Menthol cigarettes are in a class of their own. They alleviate cigarettes' irritating effects and can enhance nicotine's effects, making it more addicting, all of which makes quitting more difficult. Consider this. Despite wanting to quit the sticks more, menthol cigarette smokers tend to be less successful in their cessation attempts than non-menthol smokers. Case in point, the odds of quitting successfully were about 12% lower for black menthol smokers compared to their non-menthol smoking counterparts, reports a 2019 meta-analysis published in Nicotine and Tobacco Research. An FDA ban on menthol cigarettes may do wonders in diminishing tobacco's adverse public health effects, according to a recent Canadian study. There, researchers predicted that 923,000 adults, including 230,000 African Americans, will quit smoking up to 17 months after a U.S. ban takes effect. Our next article by Jonathan Borge is titled, Happiness Books That'll Make You Feel Good at the Turn of Every Page. These books about finding positivity, motivation, and most of all, happiness, plus relatable memoirs, self-help guides, and childhood classics, could help you look on the bright side. How so? The books on happiness featured here, not only sprinkled with joyful quotes you'll want to post on Instagram, they also provide real, psychology-backed tips and tricks for making every single day sunnier, even if the world outside is uncertain. Because these books aren't just about seeking external happiness, they're about finding happiness within. Written by psychologists and experts in the field of happiness, books like The How of Happiness, The Power of Positive Thinking, and Authentic Happiness double as guides you can easily read right before bed. Separately, certain novels like Hector and the Search for Happiness and Eat, Pray, Love, not to mention memoirs such as Shonda Rhimes' Year of Yes, explore the idea of happiness in a way that feels a little more, well, real. And who could forget Oh, the Places You'll Go by Dr. Seuss? Scroll through our list of the best books on happiness and begin your joyful journey now. Number 1, Your Fully Charged Life by Megan B. Murphy. Longtime magazine editor Megan Murphy is used to people asking how she sustains her chipper, energized attitude. She shares her secret early on in her book. Every day, every hour, sometimes moment to moment, you consciously choose to act in a positive way or look for the positive in situations. Murphy's guide is infused with the positivity she's known for, so you'll be smiling on your way to self-help. Plus, her tips on living a fully charged life are hands-on and practical, providing you with a literal roadmap towards happiness. The Gift of Presence by Caroline Welch. Are you overwhelmed by the world? We don't blame you. The Gift of Presence offers a way for readers to establish an unshakable place of inner calm, so they remain sturdy even as the world sways around them. Caroline Welch, CEO of the Mindsight Institute, blends her own mindfulness teachings with wisdom gleaned from real women's lives to create a wholly convincing reading experience. Number 3, The Happiness Project by Gretchen Rubin. New York Times bestselling author Gretchen Rubin melds academic research with real-life application in a year-long science experiment designed to understand the root of fulfillment. Number 4, The Geography of Bliss, One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World. Part travelogue, part meditation on the key ingredients of joy, The Geography of Bliss tracks one man's search for the happiest country on earth. Which countries make their citizens' well-being a priority? Where do people's positive attitudes buoy situations that are far from ideal? The Geography of Bliss is an inspiring, informative look at how people carve out a little slice of the good life around the world. Number 5, Happier Human, 53 Science-Backed Habits to Increase Your Happiness. Ready to be happy? With its action-based approach, this book turns happiness from a far-off dream to a place you can reach if you take a step in the right direction every day. Number 6, The Art of Happiness by the Dalai Lama. Part memoir, part guidebook to spirituality, The Art of Happiness finds Tibetan Buddhist leader, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and psychologist Howard Cutler, MD, in a meeting of the minds held to help you achieve and maintain what, despite great loss, the enlightened monk found many years ago, happiness. Number 7, Hector and the Search for Happiness by Francois Lalorde. What makes you smile? Author Francois Lalorde's protagonist, Hector, a psychiatrist who realizes he's not sure how to make his clients happier, travels the world to learn what's at the root of people's joy. The answers he finds are quite simple. Number 8, The How of Happiness by Sonia Lubomirsky. If you're looking for a series of quizzes, exercises, and easy-to-implement daily tips on becoming happier, this one's for you. Practice with your friends and family and see how you feel. Number 9, The Power of Positive Thinking by Norman Vincent Peale. Treating yourself with kindness is monumentally important when it comes to happiness. At least that's what Dr. Norman Vincent argues in this bestseller, which has sold millions and millions of copies worldwide. Number 10, Authentic Happiness by Martin E. P. Seligman, Ph.D. Dr. Seligman says that achieving a greater sense of joy isn't found somewhere hidden deep in your DNA. Instead, it's about rewiring the way you view the world one actionable step at a time. Number 11, Year of Yes by Shonda Rhimes. Scandal and Grey's Anatomy creator Shonda Rhimes decides to lean into her fears in this New York Times best-selling memoir that encourages you to cut yourself some slack. Number 12, Eat, Pray, Love by Elizabeth Gilbert. In this beloved memoir, Big Magic author Elizabeth Gilbert takes a transformative journey through Italy, India, and Indonesia after leaving behind her country, husband, and career. Number 13, Wild by Cheryl Strayed. With resilience as a central theme, author Cheryl Strayed's memoir follows her on a quest to self-discovery as she travels over 1,000 miles through the Pacific Crest Trail, grappling with her mother's death and a failed marriage. Number 14, Oh, the Places You'll Go by Dr. Seuss. A childhood favorite, Dr. Seuss's heavily illustrated book opens on a cheery note. Congratulations, today is your day. That sets the stage for a story about finding success in all its forms. It's recommended reading before any major life change. Number 15, A Manual for Heartache by Kathy Rensenbrink. Kathy Rensenbrink encourages us to treat ourselves with kindness, especially in the throes of sadness, depression, and grief. With A Manual for Heartache, she writes the script for finding joy in painful situations. Number 16, The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho. Paulo Coelho's internationally renowned novel follows a shepherd boy named Santiago who, while on a quest for a glamorous treasure, comes across spiritual uplifting life lessons greater than gold. Number 17, You'll Grow Out of It by Jesse Klein. Inside Amy Schumer's former head writer, Jesse Klein nails the personal essay in a collection of witty and relatable stories about 21st century womanhood and embracing your perceived flaws in this New York Times bestseller. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.